So I thought I would talk with this, start with this picture of Durham, not only because UCSB always shows a picture of UCSB and I want to get my own back, but because it's sort of nice to be at the place. I've been here about a year and a bit. I was in Leeds forever and ever before. But Durham's a wonderful place, and this cathedral and the castle, this is the World Heritage Site. And I think Durham is the only university on a World Heritage Site on the planet, I think. It's a pretty place to be. Actually, not all the world. You don't see the science departments here. They're the other side of the cathedral. But it's also nice because you may know that, I'm sure you've heard of this guy, the Venerable Bede, whose bones are buried there, who wrote the first English or British history in the 7th century, in the 670s. He wrote this famous book, The History of the English-Speaking People. Now, what I didn't know is he also wrote the first post-Roman, otherwise early British science. He wrote a book called De Rerum Naturae, and he wrote a book on De Calculationes, which is a book on mathematics of the times and seasons. So quite arguably, the bones of the guy who did the first Anglo-Saxon science lies under there, and sort of in the rocks. It's kind of nice to be working at the university where has the first British scientist sort of in the rock. And actually, it's a good year for this because although the history of the English-speaking peoples has been known in translation for a long, long time, the science books have never been translated from the Latin, would you believe, until this year. A Canadian scholar called Faith Wallace is publishing a translation of Bede's De Rerum Naturae this year, which is a good year to do it because it's also the 350th year of the foundation of the Royal Society. So it's a kind of big celebration year in the UK for science. I'm hoping we can do something with that. So if that's tempted you to come and visit Durham, then please do. It's fabulous. It's 1,000 years old, this cathedral. It's just unbelievably extraordinary place. So this is, however, we're not all there. So I'm here. Bavin, I'm sure Peter, you probably bumped into Bavin. He's moved to Edinburgh since his time in Surrey with Richard Sear. These are my colleagues. I'm usher in these departments, but I'm also in a thing called the Biophysical Sciences Institute at Durham, which is this collaboration between physics, chemistry, mathematics and engineering, and biology. Enough of that. Now, did someone have a little clicker? Because I like wondering about, does anyone have their, I meant to ask, their stick generated? That's fine, but do you have an advancer for, doesn't matter, To click on the number, I'll come and push spacebar. Okay, so this is different from the last talk. It's much, much more. It's more laughable. So it's more of a game. When I show you what we think is a genome, I'm ashamed because it's a 50 digital bit genome. So we are considerably further from reality, but hey, I'm a soft matter theoretical physicist. My approach is, very dangerous approach. And this is the ultimate collision course of biology and physics is to take the physicist approach too seriously as being the way to do things. I'm well aware of the danger of doing things this way. Let's start with the framework. Let's start building models. Let's see. Let's map out the world of the possible and see whether we might understand in principle where phenomena come from, how they might arise, and then let's have a dialogue with biology. Very bad idea, because because it's called the spherical cow. Yeah, right. This says let's think of the cow as a sphere. However, spherical cows, you're going to meet a few, I want to do some thinking around exploring different types of evolutionary landscapes. It did come up in the last talk as well. Is there evolutionary pressure? Is there a Mount Fuji of fitness to climb, or is rather a Mount Fuji? Is it a sort of alpine, craggy, Les Ouches Valley sort of landscape, or is it a neutral landscape? And anyway, behind all these cartoons, of course, is this ghost or a demon of dimensionality, and to a large extent, all are our mountainous metaphors fail in very high dimensional landscapes. And I first met this problem, in fact, Greg and I remember talking to Greg 6 years ago in this very place about protein folding. And my take on protein folding is that all the paradigms are all wrong and all misleading because they don't recognize protein folding as being essentially a high-dimensional problem, not an optimization problem. I think evolution is the same. So we're going to explore some questions in evolution by constructing some landscapes, but we are going to do it in a biologically informed way. In other words, we're not just going to do evolutionary development on the mathematical landscape, write down stochastic differential equations. We're going to be guided by the fact that evolution happens at the level of a genome, and that the fitness landscape therefore appears at the level of the genome, but that the fitness is injected into the problem, okay, if you will, at the level of the phenotype. So what I'm going to do is to explore how evolutionary fitness landscapes emerge at the level of the genotype and what they look like when the fitness criteria are imposed as they naturally do at the phenotype level. So no point clicking that. So this is mapping of sequence to function. I want to do what a few groups are now beginning to do, and that's to explore minimal models of mapping from sequence to function. I want to ask, what's the scale of these fitness diagrams? How do we know when a fitness landscape is very deep or very high? What do we mean by very high? Well, obviously, to some extent, it's to do with the difficulty of a population evolving over it. Well, can we quantify that? There are also questions of convergence here, and I, like many people, have been interested in the misleading but in some ways attractive analogies between evolution and evolution in fitness landscapes and statistical mechanics. Right. So let's just go through them. There is a fitness function. There is a free energy. There is, in some sense, a stochastic, a rate of mutation. There is a temperature. There is a question of ergodicity, and you know, convergence in the evolutionary landscape is tied to the notion of ergodicity. If the fitness landscape is large, in other words, it does have a preferred fitness point, then that will be converged to, providing evolution, the evolution dynamics is ergodic in the sense of confined, right? Okay, so there's links to ergodicity there, right? Now, the important ingredient here is finite populations, because we're going to not derive, but we're going to discover an example of a quantitative analogy pointed out for a wide class of evolutionary models, most recently by Seller and Hirsch in 2005, but they were only the last people to point it out, that actually there is a close analogy between temperature and population size. In fact, it's an inverse relationship, in that large populations are evolutionarily cool. Well, it's easy to motivate an understanding of that, because in this limit of the mutation rate and the times population being very much less than one, the point is that this is the limit in which evolution proceeds by fixing occasional mutations throughout the whole population. So the whole population marches as one through the evolutionary landscape. This is, of course, the limit in which speciation occurs. There is another limit, of course, a very fast evolution, which probably was the case in proto-life or early life before speciation. But this is the one with the statistical mechanical analogy. And high populations are cool because it's difficult. Yeah, it's much harder to spread.
This sort of very much depends on what stretch of the genome you consider. You know, if you look at a single site, that's true for most populations. But if you look at the whole genome, then that's true for no population.
Okay, that's quite true. And in fact, so I was about to say that one thing that we'll be restricting ourselves to is point mutations. But you're quite right, one can blast all this to bits by adopting a much more radical mutation schemes.
So N is the size of the population?
N is the size of the population, yeah.
It's some kind of effective
size. Or effective size, if it's asexual.
Log N.
Let's have a great discussion about that. Okay, so here's just some data from the literature from Lessig a couple of years ago on the whole population jumping noisily between two alleles in this limit, and we'll find that we've got data which support that. And in this case, there's a probability of fixing point mutations in this limit relative to wild type, which has sort of Boltzmann factors in it down there. But you'll see those will come back again in just a little bit. Okay. So let me just describe our model, what we've played with. Okay. The idea was to do a lot, create a lot of statistical data, so therefore use a simpler model that we could think of, which would capture a genotype and something like a phenotype operating at two different levels. So really we're sort of modeling, I suppose, a little multicellular worm, is one interpretation of a one-dimensional creature whose fitness, so at the phenotype level, really simple fitness, is to evolve essentially a light nose and a dark tail. Right, so the idea is to have a colouring throughout the length of the animal, and it expresses, so it's a single sort of chain of cells, if you like. It'll express a morphogen gradient, and we're actually going to choose a common physical chemical occurrence of a typical morphogen gradient that's created at one end of the organism, absorbed the other, which is an exponential with a spatial decay length of the morphogen. There'll be a gene regulation process on that morphogen gradient, which will give rise to a transcription factor, which will also have a distribution along the animal. So start with the morphogen gradient, which would be typically a smooth, non-genetically regulated, but physically determined concentration gradient. With some gene regulation, by binding the morphogen, we can turn that into a much steeper, smarter, switched version of the transcription factor, and we're just going to impose reproductive fitness on this little animal that says if you've got the lighter your front half and the darker your back half, the more attractive you are. No, actually it's asexual, so you know, the more you just have babies like mad. Okay, so here's the genotype. There's the genome. It's a 50 binary bit genome. Well, it allows to do things quickly, and this is why it's binary. So what this codes for, it's going to code for two model proteins. So one is the morphogen itself, it's going to code for the binding region, the site that promotes the transcription factor. So the morphogen acts as a cooperative binder to the RNA polymerase, which will bind here on the operator site. So we've got and we've got 10 binding sites along there, 10 here. We've got the appropriate matched binding regions to the DNA of the two proteins, and we've got 5 apiece of a little glue region. So we're allowed the system to evolve cooperative binding or anti-cooperative binding of these two, should it find it optimal to do so. There's a delta, that's a little glue energy. There are binding energies here, and the binding energy is calculated on the pairwise agreement. So 0, 0, good, 1 is good, and mismatches are bad. Okay, and there's a little energy penalty for that. And there is, of course, a real statistical mechanics going on in this model. So you'll see statistical mechanics appearing at two levels. So the analogous level I talked about at the first time, which is the effective temperature of the population size affecting probability of selecting mutations on the fitness landscape. But there's a real statistical mechanics which is going on at the level of proteins binding to genomes in a cell with a particular temperature, and we're going to calculate the probability of the transcription factor being produced by real statistical mechanics at the level of this toy genome with the two proteins binding. Is that clear? And then we can calculate the transcription factor concentration, and then we choose the mutations which we apply pointwise to this digital genome on the fitness function, which I'm just about to tell you, I hope. Yeah, okay. So the ideal super fit best in the universe transcription factor profile is that. Okay. Now, you won't be surprised to hear that this extremely primitive toy model is not able to turn an exponential decay of a morphogen into a step function. But it don't do too badly, actually, because of the cooperativity. It will steepen it up. But the fitness function is just the integral you'd expect. So we take the actual transcription factor concentration across the animal and compare it to this by the obvious integral, and that produces a fitness free energy, which we then accept or reject at the level of the statistical mechanics, Hairston, Seller, at the population. Okay, now we've assumed that for the purposes of this calculation that the functional does not change with time, so there is a constant, there's a constant in fitness in environment, but if we've got time in discussion afterwards, I think there are some quite exciting extensions of this work that might ask or explore how populations adapt to environmental change. Hot topic. Oh, by the way, this has now come out. It came out at the end of last year in PNAS, this first stage. I should come clean about that. Okay. So here's the overview of the model. Let me just go through it one more time because it needs a stick. Right, so one more time. So we're going to evolve this genome. We're also going to, by the way, just evolve this morphogen gradient. Now we have rather cheated here because, of course, the morphogen gradient will be produced by another set of genetic apparatus, okay, which in principle we could also resolve at genome level. But actually, that doesn't add anything. It adds some quantitative but not qualitative structure. So we have cheated to speed the thing up, and I'm just going to represent, I'm going to coarse grain that bit of the genotype phenotype relation by just selecting this decay length. Okay, inverse decay length alpha. So if you'll forgive us for that, I'm cheating on the morphogen gradient. I'm only going to resolve the genetic apparatus for the transcription of the transcription factor. Okay, so we're going to evolve that. We're also going to evolve pointwise. This again, this codes for the morphogen itself. Its cooperative binding to the RNAP, the transcription factor. We're going to test this thing with a fitness function. There. And we're going to adopt it with a Monte Carlo acceptance probability a la Solana-Hirsch. Yeah. No, it's all questions, stupid questions are great.
And genetic. But that on the bottom row, I mean, sort of you have that binary sequence below the purple and green rectangles.
Yep.
And with a little arrow doing that.
Yep.
Is that supposed to that interface, is that supposed to represent interaction of morphogen and the RNA polymerase with the DNA?
Yes.
Is that
the that's exactly what it is. This is DNA along here. This is what we call a binding site. This is a promoter called a promoter region. This is a bit on the DNA where the RNA polymerase binds before it chugs off and transcribes the gene, which is down here somewhere. Okay, so we're just picking out that key step in transcription, which is the RNAP binding as a switchable, controllable event upstream of a gene it wants to make, and there can be other binding agents for which, in this particular case of producing coloration, they're called morphogens. And this is, I don't know why the biologists have evolved this little crooked dog leg diagram. It's one of those things they do. Be interesting for those of you who like that sort of thing, to find out where that came from. Just like the way that biologists evolve papers with strange titles. Greg.
So the delta E energy, so it's in all cases you're matching ones with ones, zeros
and zeros with zeros, yeah.
And that happens in that delta E?
It happens in the delta E region as well.
Okay.
So the genome codes for, it doesn't just cover the proteins, it actually codes for, some of it is this bit of the DNA, okay? And other bits are the interface regions of the protein. There's not even all the proteins, you see, it's just a very, very crude model of interface binding regions of proteins and DNA.
So you're using the same bits for Watson-Crick pairing as well as for protein.
Yes.
Protein interaction.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. But don't forget, all we're just asking is what sort of, this ridiculously simple evolutionary landscape at the phenotype level, what sort of complexities might be generated by this at the genotype level? What sort of landscapes? Will they be just as obviously simple and boring? Well, of course, I wouldn't be here if the answer to that were yes. Okay. So there's a kind of a fortiori argument going on behind all this, that if we get richness out of this system, what would you get out of full-blown Watson-Crick that works? Okay, is that vaguely understood? I don't expect one to pick up all the detail, but that's, as long as you get the idea that we're working at two different levels here, a very toy genome and a very toy phenotype. Okay, so let's get some results. What did we do? We started each run with a random genome, completely random, so it's 50 binary points. Of course, one thing to say, even at this level, the evolutionary genomic world is huge. There are 2 to the 50 points in this space. Okay, so ergodicity is not for granted. Okay, by no means. We're going to evolve a run with 10 to the 7 mutations, and we're going to happen to start with various initial guesses of the morphogen gradient as well. Each time that we actually either mutate the genome at one point or the morphogen gradient, but not both, and continuous mutations. So this is what happens. So let's actually look at the output. Okay, remember, this is the function. This is the transcription agent that's trying to be a step function. Note that it is it's a lot steeper. It obviously isn't a step function, but it has, of course, exploited the cooperativity of binding of our two proteins. And in fact, it's evolved a single mechanism for doing this. It's the mechanism you might have expected. It's actually found a way of cooperatively binding, so it likes the promoter and it likes the transcription factor and the morphogen gradient to bind together. It likes them to stick. It likes them to bind together to the DNA. In fact, it's even willing to adopt a slightly over-sticky morphogen gradient that sometimes binds to both sites. Okay, so this is the reason for this little downturn here. What's happening right over here when the morphogen concentration at its highest is that both sites on that promoter region are being occupied by the morphogen, which of course prevents the transcription factor binding because the site's blocked, and it suffers a little bit of that in order to push this gradient high. And you can see that the numerical evolution finds these really rather quickly, given that we're exploring the landscape for 10 million mutations in each case. This here we are at time equals zero, of course, nothing interesting. And then this is 200 by 200,000. We've already got into the world of reasonable solutions.
I'm sorry, I probably missed something. So how does the space enter into the model?
How does the
space enter into the model?
The real space.
Yes.
Yeah. It enters. We select by, well, it enters space because as a function of space, the concentration of the morphogen protein changes. That's being generated by some other mechanism. Okay, all right. So space is only occurs via the evolved mechanism to translate a whole range of different concentrations of morphogen into transcription factors. That's how it works. That's how it happens.
Is this alpha has units of inverse length?
Yes.
So that's another way that you could say space.
So space enters in through alpha.
Inverse length, right?
Yeah, that's right.
How do you mutate that? You probably said it.
We just mutate it. We mutate it continuously, so we give it little delta alphas. I can't remember what delta alpha was now.
Walk.
It does a random walk in alpha space,
inverse length space.
Precise. Absolutely, Greg. Absolutely.
The evolution algorithm you just progressively choose for ones who give you sharper and sharper?
Well, yes, it does. Well, actually, of course, they didn't necessarily give us progressively sharper and sharper, because we sometimes, it is possible to select disadvantageous mutations, because it's Monte Carlo. We select according to the population size, recall, because we know that it's very, very hard to get a disadvantaged mutation to spread throughout the entire population. We know how that varies already. So, but let's look at what's going on underneath here, because this looks, okay, this is boring. But let's look at what's happening underneath. This looks much more interesting. So here's, as a function of time, of the evolution, two things. One is, so this is the fitness. As you can see, there are, it starts down here, of course. It very quickly gets into the region. There's a certain amount of fluctuations. There's a little bit of steppiness going on. But this is the interesting one. This is alpha. And can you see that more or less the system, actually, this is a particular population size. This is about probably 100, so we'll find out. Does it depend on the population size? What if 50 or 100? There are two preferred solutions. Can you see? And it's not true that it's settled down to one genotype. There are actually two, or families of genotypes, that that are separated by quite a high barrier in fitness world, because it takes much longer. The waiting time for a hop between one of these basins and another is much longer than the time it took to evolve to an acceptable solution in the first case. And if you look very carefully, you can see that that actually it's the genotype with the steeper morphogen gradient is slightly less fit. Yeah, than the genotype with the steeper morphogen gradient. These do correlate, and it's a bistable. There's two emergent preferred solutions about 10. One is slightly fitter than the other, but not so fit that it isn't sometimes, and in fact quite frequently, adopted in this population size. Okay. So that's that again. And of course, now we can actually look further into the details of the problem. We can ask, what is it about those the different toy molecular parameters? What's going on? Don't forget, we've got the binding energies to the promoter region. We've got the sticking energies between the two, and the morphogen region itself. Some of those may find themselves in flat areas of the landscape that might be not very well selected for. Others may be very effective in their values may be very, very carefully chosen. And you can see both of those families emerging. So here we have, it's a rather complicated plot, but you can see what's happened. Again, as a function of time, we've looked at the time series of, for example, this green thing is the binding energy of the RNA to the first region where it's not supposed to bind. Right? This one, the red one, is the binding energy of the RNA polymerase to the promoter region where it is supposed to bind. But you can see that there are in some of these, here are the three sticking energies, or three of the sticky areas. This is really just says what I said before. It says that both of these genotypes, both of them do code for the single mechanism. They both code effectively for the cooperative binding of morphogen and RNA, like that.
So did you also try to evolve all your energies as continuously as the alphas?
Yes. Well, as continuously as a...
Well, so right now you can encode them by genotypes, and that's a very discrete scheme where you have 10 different possibilities for each of the energies.
That's right.
What if you base them continuous?
Okay. No, we haven't done that. We haven't tried that.
Would you expect the bistability to persist?
I drop all expectations. I really do.
What is the alpha really wants to be like, 8.5? And it's just hard to, find an optimal set of binding energy.
Oh, no, alpha. Oh, I see. Okay. I don't think... From what I know what's going on here, I don't think that decorating these binary bits with another, with a continuous, I know what you're thinking, you might have a continuous energy variable that yeah. builds off the back of the bitwise stuff and alpha.
These two states in alpha could possibly be due to the discrete disengagers.
I see, okay, got you. I do not believe that will be the case, but my intuition has failed so many times in this project. I wouldn't believe it. Have much confidence that it wouldn't fail again.
So you change alpha, but keep the total concentration fixed.
We change alpha, but we keep the
total concentration is not fixed.
The concentration
of the morphogens.
I see the overall. We've kept the. Okay, we've changed alpha. We've kept the concentration at the high concentration end fixed, and allowed the decay rate to change. I think that's what we decided to do. There was a. Yeah, we're going to have a look. Okay, so.
So you mentioned that you're allowing the morphogen and the polymerase to bind to both sides.
Yes.
How many bindings are disallowed? Are you allowing these things to just bind together in this?
Can it bind? No, we're just allowing. Yes, actually, I don't think we're allowing this. For example, you might think the morphogen could sort of cross bind in the middle position and block both sides. You mean things like that? No, actually.
Or both these molecules bind off site
and stay off site and don't bind. Well, if they do that, you know, they can do that if they want to. That won't prevent the next binding having its own Monte Carlo test. I think more pertinent is the example where, for some reason, the RNA-P evolves a predilection for binding just in the wrong place or crossing the two sites, and I don't think we have that either. So let's just look at select a couple of different regions here. So here's a space of time where we were at the slightly lower fitness, slightly lower smoother morphogen gradient, and in this region of the genotype space, can you see that, for example, here's the binding site of the RNA to this site, which is ER1, is much less controlled than it is here. It jumps all over the place. Similarly, to some extent, with the morphogen and the promoter region. Similarly, to some extent, with the potential sticking of the RNA polymerase to itself, right? But these turn out to be less than critical. If we look at the other solution up here, these other regions, then things are much more constrained. So the slightly less fitter solution, the substitution rate is much higher. Okay, the substitution rate at the fitter solution is much slower. Look, things settle down for longer. So the barriers between the substates in the genotype at this fitter, in this fitter area of the space, are themselves higher, as well as the overall fitness being higher. That's something else which characterizes this region differently to the slightly lower fitter solution. Okay, so I mean, I just want to remind people what's going on here. We have assumed a sort of detailed balance. There's one, of course, an absolutely necessary feature of any system that has a statistical mechanical analogy is that it obeys detailed balance. Indeed, it does. It does so, and the ratio of probabilities of acceptance of a change in fitness, positive relative to negative, is very Boltzmann-like, and this, which plays the role of the statistical mechanical beta, is actually the inverse of the population size, as I said before. So there are cold populations and hot populations. This answers one of our questions straight away. In other words, the differences in fitness that matter are differences in fitness on the scale of 1 over n. Okay, so small populations blur fitness differences that large populations resolve. Of course, there's also an issue of time scale here as well. And just as there is, this is a point I do want to make, because fascinating and important one. Just as there is in statistical mechanics a free energy, which is your optimized function, so in small finite population evolution there is a free fitness. And it's the free fitness that gets optimized, not the fitness. Now, of course, just as a free energy isn't just the energy, it's the energy with a bunch of entropy stuck in. So the free fitness is not just the bare fitness, it's the bare fitness with a bunch of entropy stuck in. Well, what entropy? Well, in statistical mechanics, of course, all microstates are a priori just as likely to be adopted, modulo their energy. So in ordinary statistical mechanics, entropy biases those energetic states that correspond to more microstates. So if there are more microstates available to the world given a particular macrostate, that's what the free energy is driving you towards. Similarly, in this case, the entropy is genotypic entropy. So if there are a phenotype with slightly suboptimal fitness can nonetheless be chosen if it has high genotypic entropy, in other words, if it corresponds to many, many genotypes, because it's a bigger space to explore. It's not a deep point. Once you grasp it, you sort of say, aha, yes, of course, this must be true. And in fact, this is the answer to what is going on in this this case. These two solutions, it turns out, although they have very close fitness, they differ considerably in free fitness. So when we change the temperature, strange things will happen. Of course, as you cool down, the energy takes over and the entropy matters less and less and less. So let's cool down. Let's cool down by increasing our population size from 20 to 110. And let's calculate, which we can do. We can work out calculate the partition function explicitly here. Assuming at ergodicity, we calculate the partition function over our simulation trajectory, calculate the free fitness as a function of, and let's project it out onto the macroscopic variable which suggests itself, which is the morphogen steepness. As we've already noticed, that there have been two families of solution the system adopts with two different morphogen gradients. And sure enough, look what happens. For very small population sizes, our lower morphogen gradient one, this is the one with the lower barriers between, with the higher rate of selection of different phenotypes, that's maximized. But as we increase the population size, the other one wins out. This is the one with the higher barriers. It's the one with it also turns out to be, not surprisingly, the one with the fewer genotypical microstates. Because it has fewer microstates, its genotypic entropy is lower. But what that means is that in the cool population sizes or large populations, it will eventually win out. If it's just fitter, fitness wins out for large populations. But small populations, no. So I think this illustrates rather beautifully the temperature dependence, the population size dependence of this free fitness function. And indeed, this is the case. So you can run it for small populations and large population sizes. Small population sizes will essentially wander over here, large populations. But what about if they get very large? Okay, so low end entropy dominates, high end fitness dominates, and we converge to the high fitness phenotype. So actually, there is convergence. What you mean by convergence is what depends very much on population size. Let's go inside that last graph a little bit more, and I'm grateful to Badwin for pulling out this, I find it rather aesthetically pleasing, projection of the fitness landscape. What we've done here is to take each genotype, okay, of that was ever found in the after the original search. Let's take each genotype and plot its fitness F, not free fitness, fitness F against the morphogen gradient, keeping the genotype fixed. Okay, so and that's what gives rise to these curves. So each genotype itself lives comfortably, all other things being equal, at a happy morphogen gradient. And here we can see the bunching. Can you see? Here's a bunch of genotypes bunch of genes that all sort of peak roughly at this value of alpha of 10. And here's a huge family. Now we're looking inside that genotypic entropy, you see, who all peak more or less at this value of 7, but much more scattered. By the way, well, you can ask me, but I won't have an answer. I do not know where those kinky things come from. More work must be done. And there are some sort of rogues in the middle there.
How many curves are plotted?
We have, there are several hundred, 300, 400, I think, something like that.
So each dot on this picture corresponds
yes.
to one state that was sampled during.
One state, absolutely. One state at a particular value of the morphogen gradient.
Which is itself a dynamic.
Which is itself a state of the system. That's right. We projected the behavior of the states out in the one dimension of the morphogen gradient. Of course, there are many other dimensions which will take you from one of these curves to another, which are the dimensions of the binary genome.
So if you go back and look at the genotype of these sequences. Can identify certain features which characterize our fitness genotypes as opposed to those that reside bottom?
You can. I think that was sort of buried in some of the the selected values of some of these functions which are the binding energy. So let's see. For example, this let's look at how the system. Don't forget what the system is doing is it's adapting this part of the genome to the consequences of different morphogen gradients from the other part of the genome. So there's a very different strategy, for example, in the binding energy of the morphogen to the promoter region. So for the for the low fitness case, the lower fitness case, when there's a lower morphogen gradient, it turns out that it finds a solution that perhaps surprisingly gives you a little bit of wrong binding. Okay. And that's how it adapts for the weaker morphogen. There's not so much signaling in the background there, so it's amplifying the signal by allowing some distasteful pairing. That's one thing that goes on. On the stickiness, let's look at the one that you think might really be important to get right, or might differentiate the strategy in the two cases, is the cooperative binding across the morphogen RNA polymerase interface, which is this one. But really, there. Well, I don't know if this is surprising or not. I mean, we do find. There's a small difference. The only thing you can say, I think, with much certainty is that in the high fitness region, sorry, this is the low fitness region, it really seems to care about this. More paradoxically than the high fitness region, where it cares less, but to some extent. But what you might have expected, given less signal from the outside again, it just tweaks up, it just cranks up the cooperativity a little bit more. So, you know, that's the sort of thing you might have expected. But let's see what goes on. So this is the fitness landscape and the adoption at low population size. So these are, by the way, these are all the genotypes that have been explored at these population sizes. Yeah.
So just looking at one of those parabolic curves, so each point is a genotype, so if I look at two nearby points
yes.
and compare genotypes, what am I going to find generically?
What's happening along the parabola?
What's happening along the parabola is I'm keeping the genotype the same, and I'm asking how well does this organism do at giving itself a white nose and a black bum as I change the morphogen gradient, which is generated by the other bit of the genome I didn't play with.
But what you're asking is, how do two genotypes differ that give the same parabola?
I see. You mean so they're clearly in here. There are different genotypes that give a very, very same parabola.
I guess there's many ways to match up these genotypes to get the same energies.
There are.
And
yes.
That's probably where your genotypic is.
Yeah. So in particular, you can. So in fact, you see, you can move 1-1 and 0-0 pairs around the binding sites at will. I think the only thing that will slightly change, of course, we do have cross-binding as well. So but if the cross-binding isn't very common or important, then that's an easy way of exploring genotypic space in a very flat, very flat way.
Saturn phenomenon.
Yeah.
If you like.
Yeah. Okay. The bunching. Yes. Yeah.
The bunching. So if I cut a fixed value of the gradient, the alpha, right?
Yeah.
Then I cut through these different F values, right?
Yes.
And that seems to appear at all places in the space, right? Not only for one family, but...
No, that's right.
That's a generic phenomenon. So
yes.
What is that? I mean, why do you get that kind of...
I think that's... Oh, you mean so...
Yeah, if I cut through one of these rings of Saturn...
You mean? Yeah.
I see that phenomenon everywhere in this space.
Well, I think that's related to the last micro-discussion we had, which is that there are... you can see that there are quite a few mutations which won't change. Well, it won't change the strategy, and it won't actually change any of the binding energies. So it won't change the expression.
Well, that explains the dark, stuff.
No, that explains the dark bunching. Okay, so why this R? Okay, so so the question is, why, however, are there distinct families that all have the maximum at the same position?
Yeah.
But actually, they do look vertically shifted. And what's that? I don't know. That's a really good question.
It's like the same function, except...
It's like the same function, but slightly different. Yeah, okay. Any idea?
During the simulation... all of these things, if you could, project a single trajectory for a short interval of time on some of these plots, would it be following a parabola and then jump when it intersects another parabola?
No, it typically, actually, I think the next slide, I've got some trajectories coming up. So can I just hold that for 4 slides time? The reason it's 4 slides, what I'd just like to do is to show you what happens as I increase the population size on this diagram. And of course, what we do is insist on populating the basins, or populating the peaks more and more and more. We have less and less propensity to explore the less fit solutions, 30, 35, 40. And so what we're doing here is losing, this is seeing this free, where the free energy comes from. We're losing all the entropy that we had before by cooling down, and this is really how free energies work, of course. And in the end, we rely on this. No, so ergodicity, how is the space explored? So here's a whole bunch of trajectories, but plotted out on the parameter of the morphogen steepness against time. And this is in the, actually, n is 100 for our size system is about the limit of ergodicity, a bit higher than that, and we get glassy behavior, so I'm just about to show. But you can see we do have outliers, and what this, because it's ergodic, both things are happening. So typically we're not just staying on with the same genome, we're accepting, in a ergodic simulation that explores the whole free energy space, a typical trajectory will jump from genome to genome just as frequently as it jumps from morphogen steepness to morphogen steepness. So we explore the ergodicity by doing various things. So these are just health check, if you like. These are a whole bunch of different simulations that started with different values of the morphogen gradient. You remember, we started with 10 before. Everything I showed you started with 10. We started with 1, so it was 7, that was 10. and do an ensemble average, and we can do a time average, and at this value, the population size, there's really not a squeak's worth of difference between all those, and this is the free fitness function you saw before. So low population sizes, well, less than about 100, as far as we can tell, the simulations are ergodic. Of course, that's not obvious, because we meet again the same miracle of ergodicity that all statistical mechanics somehow has to justify. 10 to the 7 mutations are nonetheless a tiny fraction of 2 to the 50. Did you have, yeah.
Yeah, but you can just stop.
And so what I wanted to tell you about before we, that must tell us something about the connectivity, the symmetry, the representational nature of the underlying genotype space. But before we have the final discussion, which I'm coming to very soon, I should just tell you what happens to quench disorder at high end. Because when we go to a population size of about 500, we have a third type of behavior. Okay, the very low population size, recall, we've had this free fitness dominated behavior of genotypical entropy dominating. At a mid population size, we've had ergodicity, but ergodicity is homed in on the real fitness. At super high population sizes, super high for us, we're going to home in on a third behavior, which is quenched disorder and glassiness. And what we found this model does have, when you restrict, when you really have a high population, so you make what you're really doing here is amplifying the effective barriers between all the states. So if it is true that in tunneling from one state to another here, or particularly from examples of genotypes in this family to here, there are barriers that need to be crossed of low fitness, there is a population size that will render, one comes to eventually, will render those barriers insurmountable in the time scales of the population, of the simulation. And that is exactly what happens. So look at this simulation. Suddenly, these time-dependent choice diagrams take on a completely different form. It's not like there's horrible, hospital, TV series, but blip, 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 beep, the guy dies. So this is the blip, 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 beep, when the guy's dead, okay, he's frozen. Life is over. My parents are just mad keen on these appalling soap operas based on cardiac surgeons. You must have them in the US, I know. So here we go again. It's also true of these. So, in fact, what happens is it's not even the case that this family of states communicate. They don't at this population size.
But you still have mutations, so you expect small deviations from whatever you're.
Well, they're very small, aren't they?
I don't understand.
Well, I mean, the point is that what this is telling us is that when you're here, where do you go? We had this discussion near the beginning of the talk.
They don't change your energy.
They don't change your energy. You can mutate. You will mutate your morphogen gradient until you're here. But when you're there,
sure.
the only mutations you can then make are either you go within KT of the top there. Okay, 1/n. You obviously whiz around with 1/n there. But it's telling you that in order to hop onto a different genotype, there is no neighboring point in genotypical space that goes from 0 to 1 in any of these 50 dimensions that has a neutral. They're all painful, and so you die.
Really good question about just how you're doing the simulations. I mean, I think I know this is going to be annoying, but I just want to make sure. When you change the population size, you're not starting with an initial confirmation that's taken from one of the earlier simulations of it.
No.
Totally random initial thing.
Random initial thing.
And you end up on the same parabolas.
Okay, great. No, great, great, great question. Health check all the time. So what happens is Well, actually, it's true of the critical energies as well. Everyone's quenched, but non-critical energies get just quenched into one of their states. Now, so let's plot it out the different way. I've bored you to tears with plotting against the Morphogen gradient. Why don't we plot against something else? So here's a sort of fitness. Let's plot against two dimensions simultaneously of the bindings energy spaces, and let's have the fitness coming out towards you as a shaded curve. So black super fit, white very unfit, so here are two here's what I've taken here are examples of projecting out the genotypic space in the high alpha region and the low alpha region. You remember that the low alpha region was the high entropy one, but it was also the one in which the switching rate was high, indicating the barriers were low and the number of states were high. And indeed, the fitness is a rather continuous, smooth function across the discrete, of course, discrete energy, allowed energies of this. So in fact, this addresses your question earlier. In fact, it turns out that even though we've made the energies discrete, in this high entropy region, it's pseudo-continuous anyway. But where your question really bites is in the low entropy region, where it turns out the discreteness is an inherent and essential property of the behavior of that area of genotypic space, and it's rough. And we don't allow ourselves to make diagonal moves, of course, on this map. We only make rook moves. No bishops in this game. And you can see here's an example of the of why we get stuck. In order to get from here to here, we'd have to go via these diagonal spaces, and it just won't do it. So what's emerged here is a mixed landscape of smooth regions and rough regions, and that's the reason we get stuck. So. That's the end of the story. So far, that's where we are so far. So we do get what, to my mind, is an extraordinary emergent complexity for this minimal toy model. Utterly simplistic. I'm embarrassed about it. Very hard, for example, that we predict two preferred morphogen gradients here. Other take-home messages: entropy from the genotype phenotype map can bias evolution towards suboptimal phenotypes at low population sizes. So low population evolution looks rather different to high population size evolution. Now, of course, our numbers are ridiculously small, but of course, our numbers come from the energies we've adopted. You know, we could, in principle, run this simulation on any realistic population size. It just is an arbitrary choice of the fitness in our units and population size. There is quench disorder of non-essential binding energy. So just because, you know, this is an example. We've seen an example of something that might have been misleading if we weren't able to interrogate our simulations. We might have assumed that some of these values adopted by the non-essential binding energies, because they never changed, had been beautifully optimized. But it wouldn't have been the case. It just happens to be the case. They've landed in a glassy medium, local maximum. It doesn't have to be the optimum. So conservation doesn't necessarily imply function, not in this model at all. There are certainly more conserved phenotypes for large populations. There's a little I there. Convergence, story of convergence. I won't forget to thank my... So this is funded by through the Cambridge Templeton Consortium, who paid for Barron's postdoc. And at that point, I'll stop. Thanks for the discussion.
Back to your conclusion slide.
Of course, that would be a good place to start, wouldn't it?
Disorder here is here, but as soon as you put the combination, it sort of goes away.
Okay, right. So you mean, as soon as you assume non-point mutations, you mean, and time. I think we'd really have to explore it. Some of the FID moves would certainly go away. But high-dimensional landscapes are very high-dimensional landscapes, and just because you've introduced a few tunneling routes doesn't mean... So certainly you have linked together some of your valleys. Whether you've linked together all of your valleys, I don't have an intuition for. I suspect you might, but I think there might be surprises.
We've been talking about the combination...
Okay. Well, if you can't tell me by that by now, then.
No, this is. Anything other?
Yeah. Okay.
So, this is phase transition.
Yeah.
So small to large populations move between different free energy optimum.
Yes.
You don't have it here, but is.
That's right. Well, actually, so let me that's a gorgeous question. So let me just tell you about one tiny unpublished thing, but it's, because it doesn't deserve to be published, but it's I'll go back to future work. So which is a thing on evolution bottlenecks. So this is something which I hope to do a bit of work on here, if anyone's interested in talking about it. So here's the idea. So what happens when the environment changes? So this is, the idea isn't a new idea, but it's coming from this new direction. Global warming. Okay, so you're a beastie that has happily survived in Santa Barbara for millennia, for eons. Okay, global warming comes, and you're in serious trouble. In fact, you're very serious trouble. You're dying out because the you're now very poorly adapted to the new weather. But frankly, coming here from Durham, anyway. And you've got to evolve quickly. How do you do it? Suppose that the environmental change is too severe. You know, El Nino is happening every year. There is somewhere in that evolution landscape, but it's not next door. And that to survive, you'll have to move your population through a low fitness barrier. What's the strategy? The right thing to do is to start dying out, of course. Because you will just simply never get there with a large population. So you know, it's simulated kneeling, but now it's kind of simulated kneeling with a purpose. Adopting a small population is a really good idea. Obviously, you can't do this overnight. This has to work on evolutionary timescales. But if you can die out, not too quickly and not too slowly, so that the smaller population, gets you over the barrier that a large population will never achieve, then that was a very, very smart move. So you can write down the most naive thing you can do, is to write down as a one-dimensional evolutionary landscape that has a diffusion rate that that is exponentially suppressed by a population. To have a fitness landscape, and ask what's the property of a population that tries to survive. So here's a fitness landscape. This population will die out if its fitness is negative, less than zero. It needs to evolve rapidly to a point on the landscape coordinate where its fitness is greater than zero, i.e. over here. And it turns out that it can do it by dying out. Okay, it's a bit like Ash going into a dive and pulling out at the last minute. It's a very, very delicate question whether you hit the floor first or evolve. And there's a distance away from the happy zone, evolutionary speak, within which you can do it. Essentially, outside, nothing will ever happen to you.
You also have to worry about extinction and things like this.
Oh, absolutely. Right, right.
If you can do it with a small population, you can do it with a large population because they're not interacting. It's just that you're no longer in the UN, much less than one month.
The question is this: Why is it hard to pass through local fitness minima with a large population? The reason it's large is because, of course, subsections of that population can adopt this deleterious mutation, but in a large population, over the generations, they will, because they're less fit, they will typically not survive.
They might pick up the second mutation.
But the answer to your question is that they're not interacting. There's fixed resources with fixed population size.
They're interacting.
Okay.
But nevertheless, you could have second order mutation processes.
Well, you could. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that's the only strategy in the world to survive.
E. coli is a huge population that exploits basically every dozen mutations every other day.
Yes, but that's because it is that. That's because the Fisher-Wright model is not appropriate in this for its case. I mean, it does.
The problem with Fisher-Wright.
Fisher-Wright model can accommodate any number of mutations.
Mm-hmm.
There can be many.
Well, you know, bacteria adopt, I certainly adopt many, many mutations. The question is, are they able to sustain, would a subpopulation of a population of E. coli be able to sustain for a sufficiently long time a deleterious mutation that makes that subpopulation less fit in order to carry the entire population with it over that low fitness barrier into a new fitness world? That's the question.
And that's something you can calculate.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and the answer is the population...
One does calculations of this sort.
Other people do.
To what extent do you think this sort of detailed balance, sort of equilibrium description, is sort of plausible in population genetics context?
I don't trust either my expertise, my knowledge, or my intuition to answer that question. So, what I'd be far more interested in your opinions on that than my own, actually. So clearly, everything I've done is what I hope is have a fun discussion around a very prescriptive world, whose link to reality may be extremely tenuous, but insofar as it is at all not tenuous, I'd be interesting. Do you have a comment on that yourself?
Well, let's talk about this offline.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. Yeah.
If the dysfunction it's specific to the problem that you're looking at, and you have an embryo and it has some leg or some color or something, it has to develop a certain specific location on its body. What if you just make your fitness? I mean, one really popular fitness function is you just look at a particular gene, and you want to know it's some essential protein. If you take the protein out, it dies.
Right.
You want to make sure that protein's stable, and there's some arguments traditional arguments people have made for a long time that fitness function should be just proportional to the energy of the protein or
yeah.
the stability of the protein.
Okay.
That's a boring fitness function. But
no, it's not boring. Actually, in fact, I don't know if you're the only other person I know who's done something like this is in fact in that context. That's Eugene Shaknovich at Harvard, who has played with protein stability models explored protein families. In fact, he's also with systems like this, population genotype, there's a bit genotype as a protein that gets folded on a lattice and blah blah blah, and exact fitness function precisely as you've articulated, though I recall from the last thing I read from him that they've taken as far as several interacting proteins, so there's a regulatory network of proteins which all have to be there. Well, the point is that something has to be there that does the job of the protein. And I think similar phenomena actually arise.
Yeah, and the argument with the population size and everything is independent of this fitness function. I mean, it's not...
Why?
I guess my question is, some of the conclusions about evolutionary bottlenecks and population size and temperature, this has nothing to do with it. I mean, it's not specific to the fitness function that you looked at. I mean, it would be true for...
No, of course not. No, it would be true of any fitness function. True of any fitness function. And indeed, the one you've just referred to, just as there are many different ways of assembling these two proteins, cooperatively binding, blah, blah, promoting the transcription factor, there are certainly... lots of amino acid substitutions. We met that phenomenon in the previous session that would render a given protein pretty much just as stable as it was before the mutation. So there are these neutral landscapes of point-like mutations open to it. There are also, but you can also imagine, because proteins have complex lives, they typically need to do at least two things. Fold and inducing. How they fold and bind to two things. Perhaps they have some allostery, perhaps they have some cooperative binding. Sometimes proteins have to do three or four functions. Now, change the environment a little bit, you can imagine playing off one function against another. It's a slightly frustrated landscape, even for your rather simple phenotype. So I suspect that underneath there is all the stuff of glassiness, barriers, everything that we've seen. And I also suspect that this phenomenon of, you see, what this has told me is that although in this high dimensional space there are plenty of neutral directions to evolve, the very high dimensionality though is strongly modified by or intersected by these high or the low fitness mountain ranges. I keep having to stand on my head, you know. Low fitness mountain ranges that are difficult to tunnel around. Now, that's kind of a surprise, because one property of high dimensional spaces is their extreme connectivity. Very, very well connected. So it is sort of surprising that any toy model happens to generate landscapes that are subdivided in this extreme way that emerges as glassiness at low population sizes. But I suspect that is something rather generic we yet need to understand, that emerges when a very high, you know, high dimensional but rather discrete genotype is imposed upon by these rather coarse-grained phenotypical landscapes. Some very smooth that we impose at phenotype level generates this roughness at genotype level. But still a surprise. Greg?
You presented this thermodynamic analogy, and I haven't studied this area. I've never seen it before. Is that a very deep analogy? Is that
Well, it sounds as if we're going to have a discussion about that offline. Well, it's it depends what you mean by deep. I mean, often very simple things are.
Well, let me.
Are deep. I mean, certainly deep. Well, if it's deep in the sense that if you find a system that possesses it, look, you don't have to wait 100 years before someone thinks of free fitness. And you can pull in all the conceptual and methodological machinery built around system mechanics and make it work for you. So I don't know if that's deep or not.
So your analogy, N was like inverse temperature.
That's correct.
Right?
So that's right.
Usually you think of N as an extensive, but of course temperature is not extensive, right? Is there...
Well, here the whole... It's extensive in the sense... N is not describing the size of a system. We're asking a whole population
yeah.
is our microscopic system. So this statistical mechanics takes a whole population,
yes,
and
sure.
So it's not, the N isn't extensive. N is just, well, it's a property of the
temperature. I agree. I'm just saying this.
Yeah, you're quite right. So it's
surface surprise, but
yes.
Then someone, maybe it was Barsa or Richard, said maybe you should be looking at log of N. So maybe scaling by N is not...
Yeah. Well, because it doesn't matter that much whether it's N or some function of N, and of course sexual reproduction changes all this, introduces another...
For instance, you're scaling your... On one of your graphs, you scaled it by N, right? Your field.
Yeah.
But you know, the definition of ensemble here is not trivial, and that's sort of
no.
One needs to think about. But just going back to, I think, somewhat simpler question of sort of the origin of the sort of ruggedness in the landscape.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, you have some this number 50, which is somehow the length of this. Binary sequences in there. So what if 50 becomes 5? What if 50 becomes 500? Does that make it more or less rough?
That's a very, very good question. We don't know. We haven't tried. I don't think it makes it more or less rough. Of course, because the rough. Well,
presumably it goes back to Richard's question about how many discrete states you have in.
Yeah. What it might do, it might render the whole the whole space more connected. What you're going to higher, you're exploring evolution spaces with higher and higher dimension.
Right, but that's wasn't that the conundrum that you set up, that we sort of expect the higher
so
dimension
we expect
space to be connected,
and it's not. That's right. So certainly, I mean, so making n smaller is not going to make this any more connected.
Right.
So if it's rough at 50, it's going to be rough at 5.
Right.
The question that bites is, if it's rough at 50, is it rough at 500?
So isn't there a sort of subset of states for which you only have two minima with corresponding to two values of alpha that you have? And then as soon as you include all the other states, it makes it more and more rugged? There were a lot of curves that you had in your free energy versus alpha.
That's right.
Which had the maxima at the two values of.
Yes.
So let us look at those subset of states.
Yes.
Then I would presumably have a very simple free energy function.
Yes. You.
Then the effect of the other states is to make it more and more rugged.
That's right. I mean, but I think what Boris is arguing, or the behind his question, is that actually they might make all right, but they also might create some pathways that are not so rugged. I mean, they might, in general, most of the pathways these new dimensions might add might be even more rugged. But if they introduce just a few that are barrier free, then that's like that's making a tunnel through the Alps, and you'll get through.
I just meant that as a comment that maybe you might be able to sort of analytically solve it if you find the subset of states which correspond to the two, you know, simple Landau-like theory.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. No, I think that might be one possible. I guess we should finish soon, but well, he's a judge. I'm happy, but
no. So it's we can keep going with this a lot better. Thank you. We can of course keep going, and there's no